Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, you could never accuse Irish people of having short memories about the impact of the British Empire on these shores, whether that's learning about struggles to break free from the British Empire in 1916 or indeed the decline of the Gaelic chieftains in the after the Battle of Kinsale. But maybe less is known about the impact of Irish people on the British Empire and in the British Empire outside these shores. And a new RTE Radio 1 series and podcast is digging up some extraordinary biographies of people in the latter category. It's called Irish Imperial Lives. It starts on this station at 10:30 p.m. next Tuesday. And here to tell us more about it is co-host and creator A.B. Philbin Bowman. A.B., where did the idea come from?
So I've done this show with a co-host, Kate O'Malley, and the two of us kind of really bonded over a love of Indian history. And for both of us, the entry point was, how did Ireland and India both struggle to break free from the British Empire in the 20th century, looking at the parallels, the way that there were interconnections that are really interesting. But the more you look at India, the more you keep noticing, God, there's a lot of Irish names on the other side who are actually helping the British administer India. I mean, even people you wouldn't expect. Like, one of the ones that strikes me is Wolfe Tone, who we remember as this great patriot and hero who dies trying to get Napoleon to get the British Empire out of Ireland. At an earlier point in his career, had applied to join the English East India Company. Now, he never went, but lots of his other contemporaries and people of next generations did and helped that company loot Bengal and loot much of the rest of India. And you just find these contradictions throughout the imperial story. Like, another great example is Mahatma Gandhi, who's probably the greatest anti-imperialist of the 20th century. But the beginning of his career is he starts out as an English-educated lawyer working in South Africa. So he's a cog in the imperial machine, and yet that's what begins his political awakening. So it's just a really messy, complex story. And we just kept finding all these fascinating lives of Irish people who were caught up in the middle of it.
Okay, and to be clear, you're talking about people who contributed to the construction and furtherance of the empire, but all of the lives you've looked at are not necessarily in favour of, or nor do they contribute to the growth of the empire.
Absolutely not. No, it's all about it's about the interactions, and some of them are positive, some are negative, and some are just messy and in the middle. Like, another good example is John Barry from Wexford. If you've ever been to Wexford, you'll know there's a statue in the harbour, but you may not know enough about him. He's fascinating. He's born into a poor Catholic family. He gets away because his uncle has a sailing ship, and from the age of 9 he's working as a cabin boy. He makes it to Philadelphia at the age of 15, and he has this meteoric rise as a sailor and as a sea captain. And then when war breaks out, he is the right man in the right place, and he first of all captures the first British Navy warship of the entire American fleet, and he pulls off these incredibly daring stunts, like when things are really on the back foot and Washington's army is starving out in Valley Forge, they've lost Philadelphia, all he has is two barges, and he gets his men to grease up the barges in the dead of winter so that there's no squeaking. They float past Philadelphia, they set off at dusk, float in the darkness, get down and start rustling cattle in New Jersey. And the New Jersey farmers want nothing to do with this. They just want to hang on to their cattle, thanks very much. So he tries to get the cattle onto the boats, the barges, they're not going anywhere, that's not working. So then he has this ingenious plan, because the British have been tipped off. The British are sending troops to try and intercept the cattle. So they send the cattle one way, and Barry and his men cross over the river and start setting fire to haystacks, which means the British go, oh, that's where the Americans are, cross back over the river to try and go to where Barry is. By that time, Barry's long left, and the cattle get past where the British would have been. So there's all these amazing stories of derring do, and another great one about Barry, the Americans are smuggling gunpowder back from the Caribbean, and the British are in hot pursuit. They send the gunpowder into this little inlet, and Barry and his men manage to get there first, start unloading gunpowder from this boat, which they desperately need because the Americans have no ammunition at the time. And they're about two-thirds of the way through, and they realise, look, the British are sending rowboats, they're going to get here. So Barry, it seems on the spur of the moment, pours a load of gunpowder into the mainsail, sets it alight, jumps on a rowboat, flees to shore. And just as the British rowboats arrive on that ship called the Nancy, the gunpowder reaches the stern where the remaining one third of gunpowder, the whole thing blows up. It's like MacGyver. It's like an action movie. And the explosion apparently is heard from Philadelphia.
And he did it all without a Swiss Army knife.
Absolutely. Folks, I mean, how he does not have an action movie named after him, I do not know. But we're trying to recapture some of those stories.
Okay, well, you pause, take a drink of water, because that's well told. We're going to have a listen to a clip, but just set us up for it.
So we're now jumping several centuries forward to Bengal in around 1900. And this is the story of an Irish student at Trinity, who decided, I think he was just bored after his first year. He went, I'll take the Indian police exam and see how I get on. Turns out he's quite good at languages. He ends up in Bengal. And he's a guy called Charles Teggart. He worked in policing and intelligence. And whereas everyone else was writing these very boring sort of formal reports, he loved like dressing up in, apparently he used to disguise himself. He couldn't quite pass for Bengali, not surprising given his Irish complexion. But if he put a beard on and a turban, he could just about pass for a Sikh taxi driver. And so that's what we do at night. But during the day, this is what he got up to. This is Michael Silvestri telling myself and Kate about the exploits of Charles Teggart.
He made a point of driving around Calcutta in an open car with his Staffordshire Bull Terrier perched on the hood. You know, he's a subject of a number of assassination attempts, and he survives. There is an incident in 1930 when a bomb is thrown into this open car that he was so brazenly riding around Calcutta in, wounding others, but he was not hurt. In fact, jumped out of the car on foot and pursued the assailants.
Of course.
Actually shooting and killing one.
That was Michael Silvestri telling you there about Charles Teggart. You can get more, obviously, in that episode of the podcast. So all men so far, AB, let's cut to the heart of it. Is it all men you're looking
at? It is not, thankfully. But I don't want to shock anybody, but it turns out that the British Empire was actually quite sexist and racist, as were the 16th to 20th centuries. But we have tried to do as much as we can to offset that. There's one episode we're looking at an incredible scheme, which, again, I think I'd never heard of before I looked into this. It was a scheme to get Irish girls from workhouses here after the famine and send them to Australia, where men outnumbered women by about 7 to 1. And 4,000 Irish girls were sent halfway around the world on the, it was called the Earl Grey Scheme, not after the tea guy, after his son, who was Secretary of the Colonies at the time. And we try and track some of their individual stories. There's an amazing woman called Eliza Fraser. And it turns out that her mother, who'd been a single mother, had, I think, robbed a couple of items from her rich employers. And at the time, she was arrested. She was sent to Van Diemen's Land, halfway around the world, without either of her two children. And one of them applies to join this scheme, ends up travelling around the world, we think, to try and catch up with her mother, and it seems she never made it. But she herself was an extraordinary woman, and within a few months of arriving, she's married, she's met a nice convict from Dublin, seemed like a nice guy. But what's really interesting is there's a deposition in the Queensland Archive where when she was working as a domestic servant and one of her colleagues was assaulted, she filed a deposition. She spoke out and went, this guy tried to sexually assault my colleague. I mean, we know how much bravery it takes now to speak out about sexual assault. Imagine doing it in 1850s Australia.
When you're outnumbered 7 to 1.
7 to 1, exactly. So an extraordinary woman. So we're trying to tell those stories as much as possible.
Okay. Now, you've jumped forward a few centuries, then back a few centuries. But let's take it back to where you're beginning with this. How early do you go back?
So we're starting really at the outset of empire, and the sort of the perfect person to start with really was this guy we discovered. Again, I hadn't heard of this guy. The second Earl of Inchiquin. He's born in Cork. His dad is essentially a Munster warlord, caught up in all the political violence of the 1640s, I should say. And as a child, this guy is imprisoned in the Tower of London. He gets out of that. Then, because his dad's picked the wrong side, the two of them end up serving the French in Catalonia for a while. But while they're doing that, they're taken by Algerian pirates. The son loses an eye. He ends up being held as a prisoner for a year. And I'll let our guest tell you a little bit about that. He goes on then to become an imperial governor, not only of Tangier, where he's suspected because of his Irishness of not being fully loyal. And then later he's the governor of Jamaica during a revolt by enslaved people. So it's an amazing like life and tapestry in the 1600s. But anyway, this is our guest, John Gibney, telling us a little bit about the incident where he was taken by pirates.
When you say pirates, we're not talking Blackbeard or the Pirates of the Caribbean here. Okay, we're talking about, you may have heard the Sack of Baltimore in the early part of the 17th century. Another fact of life along the Atlantic coast of Europe at this time were Algerian corsairs, pirates and raiders. In the course of an expedition to Lisbon, father and son were both captured by Algerian pirates. The son lost an eye in the attack. They were taken to Algiers. They were later released as part of a negotiation. A ransom was paid. Now, I don't know how he lost the eye, whether, you know, it was a sword battle or a splinter or whatever.
With or without a patch, we have no photo evidence.
If I'm not mistaken, his dad gets out very quickly, but he is retained for longer as that captive. Am I right about that?
Yeah, he was kept as a hostage for a while, you know, I think until about mid-1661. And that was a fairly common thing as well. Like, you know, Algerian corsairs, if someone was senior enough, a ransom would be paid. Others might be less lucky and could be sold into captivity or become enslaved.
All right. So that was John Gibney from the Documents in Irish Foreign Policy, historian there, an expert himself on 17th century Irish history, talking to you there. Now, I think we have time for one more. So give us a what might be termed a household name.
A very quick potted history of Charles Gavan Duffy, who again speaks to the complexity of this period, right? He's born as into a poor farming family. He ends up getting a decent education, becoming a journalist, and he's briefly an MP from 1852 in Westminster. But after that, his health is failing, his finances are failing, so he goes to Australia to sort of restart his life. And because of his political career here and his activism for tenant farmers, he's welcomed as a political rock star by the Irish in Australia, and he ends up becoming elected to the Queensland. He ends up becoming Premier of Victoria. And the question there is, like, is he supporting the empire? Is he fighting against the empire? Is he doing both? Because when he's out there, he's still fighting for the rights of poor tenants and farmers. But in some ways, he's applying the political lessons that might have worked here to the Australian model, where it doesn't quite fit. So he just highlights that complete complexity of, you can't put these people into simple brackets of being for or against empire. It's just a messier picture than that. And that's what we're really trying to do, is build a really rich picture of Ireland's involvement through the centuries with this massive global project.
And six episodes?
Six episodes for now. If people have suggestions for more Irish Imperial Lives at RTE.ie, send them to us. We'll try and make even more if we can. Okay. But for now, it's six and it's starting at 10:30.
Okay, if you want to hear more of that, as AB says there, myself and Kate O'Malley hosting that series, Irish Imperial Lives, from next Tuesday evening on this station at 10:30. It'll also be a podcast on whatever podcast you listen to. We're back after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.